Good morning, Celia Farber.
Good morning, Jim. Good to be with you.
It's nice to talk with you, Celia. It is interesting how you got on the trail of O.J. Simpson. You were trying to do a story about him, and ultimately you were successful in getting access to him, but it wasn't easy, was it?
No, it was not. It was not easy. Honestly, it wasn't the hardest story I ever did either. It did seem like I got lucky, very, very lucky. All of a sudden, I was out in L.A. I was sent by Esquire. Didn't hope, if I remember correctly. I don't think they hoped that I would necessarily interview O.J. Simpson for this piece. The piece was one of these, you know, high concept magazine pieces. Let's do a piece on kind of like a long essay on O.J. Simpson's undoubtedly bizarre and weird post-trial life after he'd been acquitted, and he goes back to his big mansion in L.A., Brentwood. And we hoped, of course, that I could speak to him, but I remember being out there and running into such resistance in the first week one, week two, week three, week four. I was in abject despair in my little condo. Nobody would talk to me. Not the ice cream clerks who had sold ice cream to O.J. and his kids when he came out of, you know, everybody wanted, asked outright that $50,000, $25,000, and I couldn't pay a dime because Esquire was, it was not checkbook journalism. So I said, I'm sorry, I can't pay anything. And they kind of laughed. Well, good luck to you, you know. So I started collecting the story of the story, you know, the details around the atmosphere, the mood, people outside the house. Got to talk to his bodyguard, got to know his bodyguard, who was a very pivotal figure in the whole story. Tom was stationed outside Rockingham. And Tom started to give it, Tom was, you know, hungry or thirsty, I'd zip off and get a sandwich and a Snapple. And we just helped each other out. And he said, you know, ask him where he's going to tee off tomorrow next time you see him. So I did, and that was the key that opened the door. I said, in other words, he would come in and out of the gate, and I'd be standing there, a few of us, you know, right, kind of bugging him. I asked him, and he told me, and that's how the first interview, that wasn't even the most important one, but that's how the first one came to pass.
You talked to him many times through the years, and in the Esquire piece, there are several telling quotes from him, and the most telling is the one that you accent in your story. He says, even if I did do this, it would have been because I loved her very much, right? That says it all, doesn't it?
Yeah, my hair stood up on the back of my head when I heard that quote. I was here in my apartment in New York, and he called me, picked up the phone. He said, "Hey, it's O.J." He said, "I'm not done talking to you. I don't know why, but I talk to you like you're my shrink or something." And he just started talking again, and I didn't have a tape recorder. I wasn't taping it, rolling at that moment. So I turned on my my brain. Instead, my remember every word part of my journalist brain. And right up toward the top of the conversation, he suddenly said, the way I remember the quote, I don't have the piece in front of me, but I think he said, "Let's say I killed her. Let's say I committed this crime," something like that. "If I did, it would have to have been because I loved her very much," right? And then he went on from there. So I wrote that down with a little stub of a pencil that I had on a piece of paper, and it seemed to be like a little bit in slow motion. And I remember thinking, "Oh my God, this is going to get crazy." And I wanted to put the quote at the very end of the piece. Originally, Esquire wanted to put it on the cover of the magazine, but they were very nice. They listened to me, and we negotiated. And it wound up just way high up in the piece, but not on the cover.
Do you think you got access to him maybe because you look a little like Nicole?
I don't, actually. I just, So I just don't. I tell you what, why I do think I got access to him, though, because I remember the moment I was in despair. It's the second time I've used that word, you know, to be on an assignment that feels. My son was very young. He was three when I went out to L.A. And I was trained in the old school of long form investigative journalism. It was just in me that if you don't get this story, don't come home. You know, you have to get your story. Mm-hmm. And I'd been out there for almost a month, and I really, my son's father had brought him out, so I'd seen him. But I just missed him so much, and I said to O.J., so very spontaneous, I said, O.J., I have a three-year-old son back home in New York, and I can't go back and see him until you talk to me. And he stopped, he turned around, he heard that, and he said, I can relate to that, because I missed my kid so much when I was incarcerated. I remember he used the word incarcerated. And he said, I'll talk to you. And it was following that where he was going to tee off and all of that. So it felt, you know, you always kind of know as a journalist, what is it? What's the thing that causes the subject that you're bugging to agree to talk to you after all? And it was actually that.
You have another statement in your story. It says, in chemistry, OJ would be called catalytic, a compound that does not change but changes everything it comes into contact with, sometimes explosively.
Jim, I have to tell you something. There's a strange buzzer going off
on my
phone, which I think was my son set a reminder for me.
All right. Well, could you hear what I said, Celia? All right. We'll try to get her squared away. But it was a major piece, February 1998, cover story for Esquire magazine from Celia Farber, who, by the way, is the daughter of the radio legend Barry Farber. And she got access to O.J. Simpson that others did not, and some have compared her piece in Esquire to the one in 1966 that Gay Talese wrote about Frank Sinatra. But unlike Talese, she actually got O.J. to talk. But you came away, I think it's fair to say, liking him to some extent. Would that be fair?
That would be fair. Yeah, That's the complexity right there. Yeah, he was. He gave me a break, a big break. He was very nice to me. People have many times accused me, and actually most intensely the last round, i.e., the last few years. But it also happened on all the on television and the cable shows when the piece first came out. There was this whole, I guess you would say, meme. That I was in some kind of wild, you know, relationship with O.J., categorically untrue. They speculated I was in love with him, infatuated. Absolutely not. But I was also not, I didn't have a prosecutor's, you know, esprit when I showed up there. I wasn't re-prosecuting him. And so I failed in the sense those people who wanted me to do that. I wanted to just get him talking and get the story and come home with the story.
Why do you think that O.J. Simpson remains a part of people's minds and hearts all these years later, despite the travails that he has brought upon himself?
I think it creates, gives us a sense of intimacy to have a shared national unsolved mystery, although everybody for themselves has solved it, but it holds us together, cohesive, you know, at a time of total fragmentation and isolation. This just holds Americans together. I don't know, you know, and it gets ugly. It's a subject that over the years I underestimated when I first embarked on it, just how much rage was in the story on both sides, and I've really come to realize that it gets exhausting, it gets a little frightening that people feel so intensely about it. I went in like sort of like an astronaut, just very, I can just collect the facts and describe this strangeness and come home. That was sort of I didn't come into the story as somebody who had been particularly interested. I just tend to have a lot of, my mind wanders a lot, so I could never sit and watch a trial like that day after day after day. So I wasn't one of those people. It was always a bit of a mystery why Esquire put me on that particular story. Wow, yeah. I also think, I think people miss it. And there's also a slightly more cynical reason, which is that also a little underestimated how much money O.J. Inc., the story, has made for the media and the entertainment industry. The ratings.
Yeah. Well, what do you make of his life right now?
I don't know much about his life in prison. I can say this. He should not be in prison for what happened in Las Vegas, but it's moot now. He has been. That's described in detail in a chapter in the book that I wrote, ghost wrote, for Mike Gilbert. It's called How I Helped O.J. Get Away with Murder. There's a chapter, I think it's chapter 11, that's all about Vegas, if anybody's interested. It seems like he's been behaving himself, and it'd be very interesting to see what happens at his parole hearing. Knowing what we know about his personality and his way of life, you know, it's hard to picture O.J. in prison, but he's been in prison for 10 years. So I'd be curious to hear if he developed any spiritual leanings, or, you know, if he really, really got clean and sober, and how that affected him. I think the question is, will anybody ever want to hear, can he be redeemed, or is he forever the total outcast in the United States? What do you think?
Well, I think he's long going to be remembered as the man who killed his wife and another man and didn't have the integrity to tell the truth about it. Why do you think he lied?
Yeah, I've always been curious as an investigative pharmaceutical reporter, and the role that the heavy dose of Prozac he was on played in that total disassociation. That's a subject that only people who have really investigated that, like filmmaker Kevin Miller. There are people out there who know what that means to be on a 3-week into a Prozac prescription that you're taking more than you're supposed to take. Why he didn't have the integrity not to lie about it is pretty consistent with most people who are accused of murder, unless they, you know, I suppose there are those who tell the truth. That part is, it's not, I think what I'm trying to say is, it's not that unusual. We've got to come up with some other reason. That doesn't explain the obsession. What is the obsession with these particular homicides?